Judges 10 and chapter 11 through verse 11. After Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, and he dwelt in Shemar in the mountains of Ephraim. He judged Israel 23 years, and he died and was buried in Shemar. After him arose Jair, a Gileadite, and he judged Israel 22 years. Now he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys. They also had 30 towns, which are called Havoth Jair to this day, which are in the land of Gilead. And Jair died and was buried in Camon. Then the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, and served the Baals and the Ashtaroths and gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. And they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. So the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the people of Ammon. From that year they harassed and oppressed the children of Israel for 18 years. All the children of Israel who were on the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Amorites in Gilead. Moreover, the people of Ammon crossed over the Jordan to fight against Judah also, against Benjamin, and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was severely distressed. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, "We have sinned against you, because we have both forsaken our God and served Baals." So the Lord said to the children of Israel, "Did I not deliver you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites and from the people of Ammon and from the Philistines? Also the Sidonians and the Amalekites and Moabites oppressed you, and you cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hand. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore I will deliver you no more. Go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in your time of distress." And the children of Israel said to the Lord, "We have sinned. Do to us whatever seems best to you. Only deliver us this day, we pray." So they put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord. And his soul could no longer endure the misery of Israel. Then the people of Ammon gathered together and encamped in Gilead. And the children of Israel assembled together and encamped in Mizpah. And the people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, "Who is the man who will begin the fight against the people of Ammon? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." Chapter 11. Now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty man of valor, but he was the son of a harlot. And Gilead begot Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, "You shall have no inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." Then Jephthah fled from his brothers and dwelt in the land of Tob. And worthless men banded together with Jephthah and went out raiding with him. It came to pass after a time that the people of Ammon made war against Israel. And so it was when the people of Ammon made war against Israel that the elders of Gilead went to Jephthah from the land of Tob. Then they said to Jephthah, come and be our commander, that we may fight against the people of Ammon. So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "Do you not hate me and expel me from my father's house? Why have you come to me now when you are in distress?" And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "That is why we have turned again to you now, that you may go with us and fight against the people of Ammon, and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you take me back home to fight against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivers them to me, shall I be your head?" And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "The Lord will be a witness between us if we do not do according to your words." Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord in Mizpah.
Thank you, Dave, for reading chapter 10, part of 11. So, in the judges of 10 and 11, what did you notice or see that didn't catch your eye or attention at all? A few activities going on. We were just now introduced to Jephthah. He's going to play a bigger role in the next coming couple of chapters because he's one judge for Samson. Any questions or comments? Something that caught your eye? Yes, Bill.
Mizpah, is that... did Moses mention something where it says, "May the Lord watch over and keep thee and me while we are apart one from another"?
That's Jacob and Laban.
Yeah.
That final confrontation with Laban and Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
And Jacob had fled. So they met at a place called Mizpah.
Yeah, but I had my little calendar thing up here. I had my little map that actually had this foot incorrectly located, so I erased it. My description, it had said it was located west of the Galilee and south of Tob, which would put it somewhere, I missed the south of Tob, I just checked it again when he was reading, somewhere north of Jabbok River, which is approximately where Laban and with the Woodwater cross, so actually I might as well put it on there. I don't know where, though. It could be anywhere along this region, but I'm just going to put a little dot and bear with me. So that's approximately where a mitzvah would be.
So it's probably in the territory of the half tribe of Manasseh.
Most likely, it's really close to the borderline, so I don't know exactly where Gad and Manasseh's lines technically start or end. So this place, it's an important location. It happens in the past, and it'll happen again in the future. Yes, David.
The thing that I noted was J.R., as it said here, judged Israel 22 years, and he had 30 sons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like right after he died, Israel starts to sin. It's like this man that has been judging, holding the standard, keeping things intact, so to speak. And now he's gone, so it's time to play, it seems like. As soon as the cat's gone, the mice will play kind of thing. It just seems like, okay, the standard's gone. The guy that's been holding things up is no longer here. It's time for us to dabble and play in something else, it seems. And it's like the standard's dropped as soon as the guy that's holding the standard. Or, you know, that nobody steps up and fills that place.
Fills the position.
Continues that. And it goes on for another 18 years like that.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit because the way it's worded, the way you're reading it, that's what it seems like. Oh, yeah, probably the day he dies, quick, let's everybody just go party. Well, it was a little bit more progression while he was still alive. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the moment death, thus we now sin, we'll all jump in the pit. It's kind of it's a little bit more gradual than that, but not a long gradual thing. Like many of the judges, toward the tail end of their lives, the people themselves were starting to sin already again. Just like Gideon was a prime example of that. Deborah was an example of that. Othniel, Ehud, all of them. Toward the last part of their reign, people were going downhill. They finally died off, and then the people at that point were still going down. It wasn't like I mentioned before, everybody jump in the pit because he's dead now. Woohoo, let's celebrate.
Well, see, all restraint was removed at that point.
Essentially, your words are correct, but I think there's a better way of looking at it. It's not the all restraint of the people's removed, it's all restraint that God has been holding on to. He waits till that judge, who he raised up, dies before he says, okay, Now I'm going to flood all this misery back upon you because of the stuff I've been holding back the last few years while this judge had done what was right. He followed the best he could until his death. I held it back until after he died, so you didn't have to see this. So, and that happens, well, quite frequently. Judge, so it records it like it's instantaneous. But it wasn't quite that way. It's more of a God saying, yeah, you guys deserve it. You deserve it. I'm just waiting until he dies. Okay, now, bam. All this misery is going to flood upon you.
You see the same thing with Solomon. You know, God judged Solomon for some of the crazy stuff he did. But he tells him, you know, you will die in peace, but the kingdom will be broken up by your son.
Exactly.
You see this pattern where he has mercy while that...
One good person was alive. And
alive. Even with Moses, to an extent, in some way, it's true with him, because as long as he was alive, everything was together, and then God tells Moses, all this stuff's going to happen after you're gone, but anyway, you know.
Yeah.
But yet, you see that God did hold them together, at least as long as Moses was alive.
Exactly. And the same with Joshua. Yep.
You know, he held things together. Joshua did what he needed to do as long as Joshua was alive. Held things together.
Now, they're still corrupt. They're still doing things like they should have done toward the end of it. And the judge did the best they could to try to stymie that. But you're a human being. You're only limited for so much. Any other comments or questions that caught your... Yes?
I thought it was interesting in comparison. Gideon had how many sons?
70 sons, yeah.
And
oh my God.
Abimelech was the son of another woman.
Right.
And here we have 30 sons, and they go to Japheth, who is the son of another woman.
Right.
So there's a little bit...
There's a lot of parallelism that happens again, the same type of thing going on here. We'll discuss that a little
they
bit.
They must have read and didn't want Jephthah to do the same thing.
Well, Gilead was a very important person, and there's a reason why they named the whole region after the guy. He was a very powerful individual. He was a Manasseh, descendant of Manasseh. We discussed back during Joshua and Moses' time when they divided him up, the half Manasseh that was all the warriors and the people that were extremely talented in battle, they were with, they're all Gileads, or they're actually Gilead's father, and then him, and then of course all of his sons and whatnot after it. They named the whole section after him, which technically is larger than Judah's whole tribe, territorial area. He's a very important individual. Yes, Richard.
I know, I said this is the same one, book of Numbers. You say he is a son of Manasseh.
There are two Gileads. There are two Gileads. So don't get them confused here. There's one that Manasseh's physical...
Well, the name he used.
Manasseh's first child was named Gilead. He's actually one of his first children.
Yeah.
That's a separate Gilead from this one. This is the guy who was named after that first one. All right, this guy was more important.
Okay.
When one thing the Bible allows you a little bit is... The son of doesn't necessarily mean a direct
right.
child. It can
right.
also
mean
grandchild. It can also be great grandchild. They don't care. They note, oh, here's an important man. Five generations out, here's a really important man. Obviously from the same person. I mean, Messiah, son of David, right? Well, obviously David didn't physically give birth to Messiah. It was generations later, right?
That's
the same principle.
I'm thinking of this guy named Jair.
Yes. He was, I believe, it was Jephthah's, I think, one of his older brothers, well, half-brothers.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it right up front. That would be verse 3.
I found it very interesting when they finally had enough and cried out to God again. He reminded them that he'd rescued them and said, go talk to your other gods.
Mm-hmm. One thing we always do is when we're in happy and content and every life's going great and wonderful, we tend to neglect the things that got us that and got us there, which was God himself. And they say, hey, you know what? I did it 7 times already. Enough's enough. Now it's your turn. Go trust in those people that you thought were good during the times you had enjoyed your life. Yes, Bill.
Kind of like after World War II or Korea where we were... Country was getting together and calling on the Lord. And then after the war is over, things start going back together and they kind of go
I don't need you anymore.
Call you next time.
That's part of human nature.
Yeah.
That's part of human nature. We do that. Oh yeah, when he's pointed out, if we heard him or not, but it was that World War II in Korea, you know, people in the U.S. were all praying, very religious, you know, very important factors in our lives. And of course, as those wars ended, guess what? God who? It was not instantaneous, but it did eventually go there. And that's essentially where we've been for a while now. Okay.
So how much misery are we going to have before it changes again?
Misery is in the, eye of the beholder, I guess. How much misery is too much for one person is not enough for another. say that again.
Oh, I just said, do we need to have our land taken away from us and go into captivity?
Well, we'll find out. Hopefully not.
Well, that only happens to all the third world countries other than us, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully that won't be the case. I mean, he's done that enough times, and we pray we actually learn and retain the information of the lesson. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and jump in my little commentary here. Now, as we go through, obviously, Judges chapter 10 first. We'll get to chapter 11 in a few minutes. Starts off Tola, son of, what is it? Pua, son of Dodo, man of Issachar. So, where's Issachar on my little map here, on my handy-dandy map? I know it's a lot of bunch of lines over the place, so I'll try to point out what I've...
Right there.
Yeah, you're right there. obviously, it's the Dead Sea of Galilee. I have in red my various surrounding nations that are adversaries to Israel. And I broke up my little dotted lines dictate where, of course, all the various tribes' approximate borders are. Issachar is right here, which is just south of Lebanon, a little bit west of Asher and just north of Manasseh, or half Manasseh. Shamir, where he dwelt, down here in Ephraim. He actually didn't dwell in his home territory, which is not uncommon. So you can dwell anywhere. There's no rule or rhyme or reason that says you must just stay in your own territory that God gave you. You can move around. You just can't own property. That's the only deal. So he dwelt in Shamir, which is a small town just north of Shechem. Literally just a short distance north of Shechem. They're all in the same mountain range of Ephraim's mountain range, which runs the spine of Israel. Why would he come down there to judge? Why couldn't he just judge in Issachar? No, the reason I'm bringing this up because guess who also came down there? Well, Gideon came down there to judge. Deborah was down there to judge. Joseph was there to judge in that tight little region of Ephraim. Yes, Tammy.
Shiloh,
exactly. Where is Shiloh? Well, about 2 or 3 miles southeast, just a short distance away. That's what you want. You want a judge that will go to, I guess, services, but you go to and worship God. That's the whole point of being a judge, is you will do what is godly. Contrast that to Yair. Where was he dwelling? Over here in Gilead. Where of all of his sons and all of his property and everything else associated with it was with him. That's how he judged. Was he ungodly? Well, no, we're not arguing whether he's godly or not. The point is, dwelling near Shiloh wasn't very important to him. For whatever reason. It was to Tola. He thought that was important. That's why he moved. I'm sure he took his family with him. He couldn't own property there. But that's why the other judges went down there. They didn't own property. No matter what judge, what tribe they were from, they came to that location. Remember, only Joshua is the one who actually owned property right there. That was his little town. That's it. The rest of them didn't. They were just guests. Hold on a minute. Yes, Ellie.
There's a town in Bashan called Ashtaroth.
Yes, there is. So that's been around a long time. Still around, actually, today. It's a slightly different name, though. But it's still around. They re-spelt it. Nobody likes the, you know, for obvious reasons, they respell a lot of names that were once pagan names, and they kind of re-changed them a little bit. Ashtaroth is also a goddess. They're one interchangeable words, much like we use from Easter. Yes, Tammy.
And And maybe the connection to Joshua, the first judge after Moses, could be another reason that they would, you know, be there too.
That's true. Joshua was one of the greatest judges Israel ever knew, with the exception of Moses himself. Not bad to be associated with him. What are the advantages come to being associated and being right in the heart of Ephraim?
Protection.
Yeah. Now, Ephraim is one of the more powerful tribes at this point in time. As I mentioned over the last few times we've been up here discussing Judges, the last couple, almost about 100 years or so have gone by over the past month and a half. And it's kind of odd, but about 100 years go by, and Ephraim, how many wars does Ephraim have to deal with? Well, actually, very few. They've been able to grow and be very prosperous. They live in a territory or a location that is very fertile. Not the most fertile, but it happens to be very fertile. And when there's no wars to fight, and all you got's farmland, what are you going to do? You start farming. You start becoming wealthy. You start growing. And what happens when you become wealthy is when you have children. That's a prosperity thing. I mean, we see that in every population on the earth. Yeah. Is that the more prosperous a nation or territory is, guess what? More kids start being popped up. So Ephraim is actually becoming very strong. And actually, they're going to be a player in the next couple chapters or so of getting a little too strong for their britches kind of thing. But great place to be located. Safe, secure, centrally located, near Shiloh. You can travel wherever you need to go to judge whatever matter that shows up. That year was a little different, though. He dwelt in Gilead with his sons. Presumably his sons traveled all of Israel and probably did judging as well, but you can't prove it. Play on word. 30 sons, 30 colts, 30 cities. Doesn't seem odd? Why isn't it he had 30 sons, and of course he probably had 30 colts naturally, but and not 5 cities? Not 29 cities? Why was it 30, 30, 30? What's the point of that? Yes, Ellie, you have an idea?
Threes, always, anytime there's a
three. It's a set of three in a group of 30.
Three sets of 30.
It's repeated, yeah, yes.
Always got a messianic connection to it.
True, it does. True, it does. So we don't know what the messianic connection might be?
Where's Havot being?
Oh, sorry, say it again?
Where's
Havot
being?
Havot?
Havot, Jair.
Oh, towns. Sorry. Havoth. Unwalled towns in particular. Okay. Not just any town. It must not have walls. They were not military towns. They were not cities. It must not have a wall.
Right. Okay.
I'm not telling you that I have the perfect answer for this because I don't. It's an interesting conundrum that it was brought up. And it is. Sets of threes, which are usually associated with the Messiah some way or another. What is this particular one? There's probably about half a dozen. Yes,
well,
Ellie.
Also 30 sons who rode on 30
donkeys, exactly.
The Messiah rode on
a donkey, exactly. You have a firstborn. You draws your mind to the idea of something that this Messiah associated here. I'm going to leave it at that because I don't have a good answer for it. I know it's something's there. I just can't point that. I can't figure it out myself. So if one of you think of it in the next hour or so, please raise your hand and tell me. All right. I do believe there is a significant point, the fact they are unwalled towns, has to do with who they were and where they went and where they were traveling, but I'll get that probably some other time. So, if you do come up with an idea or something that catches your eye, please let me know. I think it's interesting that they would have to be worked in that fashion. I just don't have a good response to it. What happened during Tola and Yair's judgeship?
There's not much reported at all.
Exactly.
No specific military campaign.
Exactly.
No.
Nothing really important going on. Why not? Well, why didn't they record something? What were these guys doing all day for 45 years combined?
Making judgments,
but wait a minute. Well, we're dealing with people who are right after the last one dies, or so they're worshiping every god under the sun that they can find, except the God of Israel.
Right.
So how they couldn't be making righteous judgments per se. You're judging people who are horribly corrupt. Not obviously their whole lives, but they were progressively getting corrupt. So what all is going on here? Israel lives in relative peace, which, of course, as I mentioned before, spawns
big families
and desertion of what got you that peace. All right, that's what people do. We all know that. We have it many times in this past so far. So these two judges for 45 years, judges were also warriors, right? Not all. Not all judges actually had to go to battle. Right. The judge can be a leader. It can also be a chieftain or a warlord. But its judge doesn't necessarily have to be someone who is a warrior. Who would be going to battle during this time? Instead of these judges. Because keep in mind, 45 years go by and there's not a war. Even today, we can't go by more than 2 years without us getting a war in something. All right, so how can 45 years go by in a territory where everybody else hates their guts and nothing happen? Chapter 11, did you notice who Jephthah was and what he was doing? Oh, that he's not the only one, but he is one of the answers as to what's going on during the lifetime of these two judges, because Jephthah was alive during Yair's reign. Who was he? What did they say he actually was? I know I'm jumping ahead, but I'm going to do this anyway.
He's basically a warlord.
He was a warlord.
He was doing what David was doing.
Exactly. He's going around marauding, pillaging, destroying. Yeah. Who? What? Well, he's located here in Tob, which is a territory, mind you, not a town. Who's nearby that he can attack?
Ammon.
Ammon's right here, Syria's right there, and Sidon's just north of him. Go on raids.
Yeah.
That's what's going on. It points out that Jephthah was doing that. Mind you, chapter 11, the first couple of verses there, is actually a flashback to history. Oh, this is what he was. His brothers threw him out. He went up here. He attracted other unscrupulous individuals. And they sustained themselves by robbing and stealing from the local people they didn't like. Which in this case is most likely to be Ammon, which we'll play in again in a minute, shortly here, because there's a reason why Gileadites went up to Jephthah and said, hey, we have Ammon to deal with. Why'd they choose him?
Because he's sitting right there next to Ammon, and he's been fighting him.
He's been fighting him for years. Right. He knows how to fight. He knows how to fight their style. That's why he was selected. It wasn't just an arbitrary choice. They could have chosen anybody. They chose somebody who they thought was the best choice. Somebody who's been attacking and pillaging and destroying Ammonite small little towns and villages for probably decades. So he's one of them who's probably been fighting while these two judges are judging. And not to mention others probably down south along the same lines in Judah's territory, doing the same thing, fighting back and forth nonstop. So there wasn't a big massive military campaign. Just two judges doing the best they could to judge what they were able to judge. Now, verse 6, God lists 7 different offenses of chapter 10. Oh, geez. Yeah, he lists all of them. Okay. Worship the Baalim, Ashtaroth, the gods of Aram, or also Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the children of Ammon, the gods of the Philistines, and they forsook God and did not serve him. Note, this is actually a separation. Something happened here. This has not happened before in Israel's history. Worshiping the gods happened. Now, who cares? It happens. They do that all the time. But while they were worshiping those other gods in the past, they did not abandon the God of Israel. He was still around. The philosophy that Israelites took was the same philosophy the Canaanites had. That yes, there is a big deity up there in the sky. And he has lots of deities that we interact with. There are messengers back and forth. This deity, Baal of so-and-so, Baal of this, Baal of that, that makes a difference. This is my personal deity of my own little town, my own little home. And this is the one that I pray to that he'll deal with the big up there in the sky person. That was the philosophy. So it was okay. You can worship your small one because you're also worshiping the big one at the same time.
Very Catholic.
Very Catholic, that's true. And it's not just Catholic. A lot of religions do that. It's not uncommon. I won't list them off. I only know of a couple of them, but enough, the fact that I know of them. It's not uncommon to do. That's what they were doing.
No, what are they doing now?
They ignored God altogether.
They completely ignored God altogether. Because before, though they may have worshipped their small little deities, they still worshipped the God of Israel at the same time. He hated it, but they still worshipped him. Maybe not the way he wanted, but they still did it. At this point in time, forget you, God. I'm not going to worship you at all. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you did. Yeah, we can all relate to that in some way or another. And God says, hey, you know what? This is what you wanted. Fine, this is what you're going to get. He raises up Ammon, of course. They come in, they crush Israel. Unique things of Ammon, they change strategies. Children of Ammon, which of course we also do with the Philistines as well, but they're more localized rather than actual all of Israel. Because I mentioned before, they're always continuously fighting with Benjamin, Dan, and Judah, and Simeon nonstop. That's the Philistines, that's all they do all day. Ammon comes in, he takes Gilead, takes Reuben, and crosses the Jordan River. So he owns, essentially, or control over, half of Manasseh, all of Gad and Reuben. He attacks Ephraim, which I mentioned before, the safest place to be was Ephraim. They were the strongest. But he attacked Ephraim. Now it says, Judah, Benjamin, and Ephraim. Did that tell you where they crossed? Probably right at Gilgal, where who crossed before? Joshua. He crossed at Gilgal. They're going to cross right across here. You get all three tribes all at once. Quite convenient. That's what Moab did. And that's what they got burned for it. Or they got retaliated, I should say. They would notice there was no fire. They were wiped out as a result for doing, or their king was. Not Moab still existed, but they were much weaker at this point. So Ammon did that. Midian did the same thing. Crossed here as well as the Jabbok. There was a Sukkot and, you know, Gideon having to cross over and Sukkot territory. They crossed the Jordan where the crossings were. Ammon focused further south, where the strength of Israel is. The house of Ephraim, Benjamin and Judah, the strongest tribes. The core. If you can conquer the head and the whole body fails, a simple basic principle. They came across, they attacked here. I think this is the funniest statement that Shilj Major could have made to God. This is my personal opinion, of course. Of course, they say, oh, we forsake God, please God, save us. And God says, yeah, go. I've saved you all these times for the Egypt, Amorite, the Ammon, the Philistines, the Sidonians, which are the people up here which attacked Asher earlier, or a few chapters ago. Where was I? Sidonians, Amalek, the guys in the south. Ammon, or Ammon, is actually a territorial concept of religion, which is right in the heart of Judah. It's actually a people, the Canaanites, technically were Ammon. Cried out, go cry out to the gods. Okay, this is what I think is funny to me. Verse 15. The children of Israel then said to the Lord, we have sinned. May you do with us whatever is good in your eyes, but rescue us now this day. Wait a minute. Wait. Let me get this straight. God, you can punish us. That's okay. But save us right now.
Save us first.
He brought Ammon up as the punishment. That was the punishment. And they say, okay, no, God, you can punish us, but not like this. I think it's comical. I mean, it's like they don't realize, or at least they're trying to persuade God not to use this method. But they don't realize that God's the one who allowed Ammon to come across. It wasn't that it's just a random occurrence. That was the punishment. They couldn't take that punishment. They preferred a different one.
Did they really see it, though? I mean,
I don't know.
There's things that happen that...
But you don't realize why it happened. It just...
People are clueless.
Mm-hmm. God save us from ourselves. Yeah, that's what happens. It does happen. So I can't swear they actually understood that this was the punishment from God. But I do believe they understood that it was a punishment of some form. Because they already said, it's because we worshipped all these other gods. And then they had to get rid of all these other gods. And that, so they understood that concept. And God, of course, probably through a prophet, had told them, hey, go trust the gods you believed in. So they realized that this is from God. They just didn't like the punishment that they deserved. They want a different punishment, different God. Yeah, exactly. Who does? Yes, Ellie.
It's like a kid that says they disobeyed. Okay, you lose the computer for a month. Can't you just not feed me for a month, please? And let me have my computer?
they prefer a worse punishment. it's difficult to be to fall in the hands of living God, or how that phrase goes. The punishment they've chosen is a little bit harsher. But what does God do? He has mercy on them. He hears them. It's amazing. I mean, most of us, I believe, would be so infuriated with our children doing something stupid. It's like, hey, you know what? You deserve it. You live in the bed you're in. When you finally figured out that you've screwed up your whole life, then come to me and we'll talk. But you got to clean up your own house first. Well, that's just what he did. They had to clean up their own house first. They had to return to him. Now, will they stay? Of course not. He knows that. They're not going to stay with him. But the fact that that they return, that's what matters. And that's what he focused on. One hand in time. Yes, Ellie.
Well, that generation usually
stays. That generation usually does stay. That's true. I did misspeak. I phrased it with a large paintbrush of all of Israel didn't stay with him. But you're right. Each generation has righteous people in it. And those are the ones that God selects. I have to admit that. She got me on that one. Yes, Tammy.
Yeah, actually, when I was teaching Sabbath school earlier today, they were going through this thing and talking about Yeshua and, you know, how he cast out devils and how he was criticized for how he did it and why he did it and under what authority or power he did it. And it made an interesting comment that said, Yeshua is perfect. He was a perfect son of God, never did anything wrong. If his arguments were not convincing enough, how will ours be more convincing?
They won't be.
Exactly. And so, you know, and then they talk about a little bit about the pattern of, you know, repentance and backsliding and this kind of thing. And that's the same pattern you see there.
Exactly.
God being perfect, you know, God did, you know, God made Adam and Eve perfect. He made the earth that he made for them was perfect.
And it doesn't stay.
That's one of the biggest reasons why it's so ludicrous for people to look at Israel and say they blew it and God has put them away. Because
it's a whole, you point one finger, how three are pointed back at you kind of thing.
And one.
And God, yeah, it's a thumb. Good point.
You point that way, yeah.
Well, okay, so let's see, where was I at? Yeah, their response, so God has mercy on them. Now, my words that says his spirit could not tolerate the misery of Israel. Just couldn't handle it. So what does he do? Well, we don't know what he does, but we do know what Ammon did. They retreated. The children of Ammon, verse 17, points out they were mustered and camped in Gilead. Meaning they actually were attacking Ephraim, Benjamin, and Judah, and now they retracted back to their base, or close base they had, which was Gilead. So they actually retreated some. That was his mercy. I will not allow them to conquer the west side of the Jordan. They'll stay on the east. Which means
Gilead's in trouble.
Yeah, Gilead's in trouble. But Judah, Benjamin, Ephraim, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Simeon, they're now no longer in battle. They're no longer engaged in battle with Ammon.
But they can assemble.
Well, yeah, they can assemble, but they're not actually active battle. There's no defensive going on. It's more offensive now. They still have to deal with the Philistines, nonstop issue, but they don't actually sit there. It's not a divided front. They do a two-front war. That's a problem. Most countries don't survive so well along with two-front wars. There are very few exceptions. So now it became more Gilead. What else did he do with the people in Gilead? No, Ammon's been conquering them and breaking them and destroying them for 18 years. All right? Most of us don't have a whole lot of, not brave enough?
Yeah,
moxie. Moxie, yeah, a little chutzpah. To sit there and stand as, okay, now we're going to fight. after 18 years of having your families pillaged and destroyed and killed. Most of us are tired. Wears us out. But he doesn't. What does God do? He says, all right, Gilead, rise up. So that's what they do. They rise up.
Well, yeah, one way of Israel constantly being bombarded with all this stuff. They're just sitting there. How long are they going to take it?
How long are you going to take it?
How long are you going to take it?
Until God says,
stand up.
Okay.
They say, blessed is he who comes from the Lord.
Yeah, so they may not require that. Okay, so he retracts Ammon back to Gilead territory. He brings Gilead, the people of, which include people of Gad, and it also includes people of half of Manasseh and part of Reuben. Gilead's actually a very large region at this point in time. It's growing in size because the populations are growing in size. They're more prosperous. So it's actually getting fairly large. And that's unlike this side of the Jordan River. All these territories and tribes are confined in their little borders. While on the other side, there is no confinement. You can go as far east as you can walk. It's all yours, as long as you can control it and take it. So they have plenty of expanse that they can actually increase by. So that's not a problem for them. So increasing territory is not an issue. Maintaining it is. That's one of the problem. So he raises them up. And now we're in chapter 11. First of all, questions in chapter 10. I'm going to move on to 11 otherwise. I don't think they may have missed some points here or there, but I'm hoping it wasn't too bad. Okay. Chapter 11. Oh, yes.
Well,
Tammy.
Down here at the end of, you know, like 18, it says here, the people and the leaders of Gilead said to one another, who is the man who will begin to fight against the sons of Ammon? He shall be the head over the inhabitants of Gilead. So they're starting to think about how are we going to
organize this, right.
Lead us, who has the smarts, the whatever,
the ability
to do this.
Exactly.
And they are coming up their list now.
Yeah, and guess who's probably the top of their list? Mm-hmm. Chapter 11. Now, but we have to go flashback, because we just pop up, oh, well, then there was Jephthah. Well, no, who was Jephthah? So let's flashback a little bit, find a little bit who Jephthah was, and then we'll bring it back up to what's currently happening. So, of course, in verse 1, starts out, Jephthah, of course, Gileadite, again, descendant of Gilead, mighty man of valor, son of a harlot or a strange woman. It doesn't necessarily have to be a harlot. It could be a concubine. It could also be someone from another race. It doesn't make much difference. The point is, not a wife. That's key. Son of a woman who is not a wife of Gilead. So, but note, it's his lineage to Gilead is never in question. Everybody knows he's a son of Gilead. It's just a matter of what woman he's from. That's a whole other problem. Gilead's wife bore mother's sons. Of course, they grew up, got rid of Jephthah. Don't like him. Why? Well, as Kathy pointed out, we've heard this story before. The son of a strange woman is not necessarily a good thing. It doesn't have to be a bad thing, but not necessarily a good thing. We hear the story. It harkens memory back to
Hagar.
That was the first one I thought it was Hagar and Ishmael and Sarah. Is that who was Ishmael? Obviously, son of Hagar. And what did Sarah do? He will not have inheritance with my child. Get rid of him. Was that a bad thing? Well, no. This is Sarah we're talking about. She did precisely what she thought was right, and it just showed out that it actually was right. She did exactly what God said. Hey, that's correct. Do exactly what she's told you to do. Not that he really wanted Hagar to be, you know, within her. Hagar and that whole scenario was a concoction of...
It was part of
the plan, but it was a concoction of not necessarily of God's plan, per se. He had originally desired Sarah having a child, but...
Actually, Sarah's plan.
Yeah, that's true, Sarah's plan, and just she kind of backfired on her. Yeah. Next person who also had a problem with it.
Gideon!
His own child, Abimelech.
Yeah.
That does more recent.
That, yeah, they know that.
They probably read.
Yes. Someone probably was still alive.
Yeah.
45 years ago, that's it. There's probably some people, hey, you know what? You know, don't do this. Get rid of this guy now. Because all it takes is one person with a little bit of chutzpah to sit there and say, hey, we're going to go ahead and kill off these other sons and take over the whole place. That's in memory. So, getting rid of him, is that necessarily a good thing or a bad thing? Neither. Just something that they did. So, They rise up. They get rid of him. You're supposed to put another woman. So he flees. Where does he flee from and to? Well, this was to point out, it's approximately in this area. I can't swear exactly where it's located at. But Tov, which means good land, land of the good, or a good territory, is north of there. A little less populated. Not that it wasn't populated, just a little less populated than where Ramoth Gilead and the rest of the territory was, which is heavily populated, where the core of Gilead is located. Tov is a little further north. Out of the way, I'm not bothering anybody. I'll live here. What about his family?
What about who?
Jephthah's family. Did they go with him?
No.
No, they didn't. They stayed home. His wife, his children, his possessions, all stayed home in Mitzvah. He had to leave. They drove him out. Why? Because what did the sons actually want? Well, all the possessions. They're not going to sit there and say, okay, yeah, leave and take all your possessions. No, leave all your possessions because we want them. That's the whole point. We want to be rulers. We want to own our descendants or our ancestors' possessions. Not you. We don't want to share this stuff with you. So you go. We'll keep everything else. Yeah, we'll keep them alive because they're descendants of ours, but or they're relatives. But we're not going to let you keep them with you. So all of them have to stay home. Does he visit? Probably. We weren't discussing visitation rights. We just discussed the fact that he had to dwell further north. As a married but partially single, or a separate person, bachelor in particular, who was accustomed to doing battle, what usually happens?
Gets other guys
who are just like him. You know, birds of feather. Yes, Ellie.
This, when they drive him out, is similar, the same thing that happened to Joseph. Because the other sons didn't want Joseph to have the inheritance. Get rid of him.
Exactly. So, we've heard the story, we've seen it before. It happens. Now, in the past, it's always been good or bad. Well, neither. It's been both good and bad. In Joseph's case, that was great. Abimelech's case, it would have been nice had they gotten rid of him. Not so good. And in Hagar's case, well, yeah, that was actually the right thing to do. So it was good. So we've had a mix. In this case, was it good? Probably not, but maybe it was. Because has he not been up there, would he have been fighting the children of Ammon for years? Probably not. He'd have been home with his family. Well, now that he's been up there for probably decades at this point, he actually has the skill level to lead unscrupulous individuals to plunder the Ammonites. Not necessarily a bad thing that he was driven out.
But didn't they know he was that already?
He knew that he was a man of valor, I mean, a man of war. He has that ability. But who or what he did as far as his lifestyle doesn't specify. Because it points out the boorish men, and they made their living through marauding and Tov. What he did as a person in Mitzvah was probably what all of his family did as a person in Mitzvah, or that whole territory, which is they have families, they have possessions, they have farms and cattle and whatnot, as well as going to war whenever they feel like it or need to, because they happen to be in the front lines continually. So at any moment, they drop their stuff and go battle and come back a month or years or never, whatever happens to them. So they knew he could fight. That was never in question.
Could he lead?
That was question, because he was just expelled. Does leaders get expelled?
No.
Sometimes, but they usually aren't very good leaders. So we went back to the past, got some info. Now we know who he was. Let's come back to the future again, or present, I should say. Verse 5 and 6. It happened, children of Ammon waged war. They're catching up the story again, just we just read in chapter 10. Waged war in Israel. The elders of Gilead went to Jephthah to get back from the land of Tov. They said, Jephthah, come, be our chief, and we will do battle with the children of Ammon. Did they say, come, be our leader?
Commander.
The leader of the army, really.
Not a judge or leader of the people, though, is it?
No.
There's a distinction. They actually offered him first, come and fight for us, be chief. What did Jephthah do? Excuse me? Who do you think you are? You drove me out. You didn't have come back from remorse or sorrow that you got rid of me. You come back because you need help. And is this my battle? No, it's not. Because what's been happening to Jephthah? Well, he's been living in Tob. Marauding, pillaging, doing whatever he wants. The children of Ammon. Been doing it for years. Including the last 18 years that Ammon's been attacking all the rest of Gilead and Israel. What has he been doing? He's still marauding and leading and taking out small villages and small groups of bands of people of the children of Ammon. His life doesn't change and hasn't changed since he was driven out. So is the battle actually his? No, technically it's not. Because if the children of Israel lose the battle, what happens to him?
Nothing.
He's doing the same thing he's currently doing. Nothing happens. Nothing changes. He may or may not lose some of his family members, but that's a separate story. His life doesn't change, so it's not his battle. They're asking him to come help as a citizen of Israel, or as all of Gilead, technically, because they're a little more pride. Like we see the pride of Texas. It's a more of a family thing. You know, the state has its own mentality. Well, Gilead has their own mentality, much similar to how Texas has its. Well, California's a little different, a little less military, a little less gunslinging style, but California's got its own as well. So his battle, he doesn't need to go to this war, but he does it, but not yet. Well, let's make some negotiation deals first. Okay, yeah, I can come be your chief, and what does he know what happens at the end of I win this battle? What happens to me? I'm re-expelled to Tov, because you guys don't want me. He knows that. They're going to keep him. And they got to sweeten the deal a little bit. Okay, fine. So, we go along here and says, Jephthah's response to others, was it not you who hated and drove me away from my father's house? Why have you come now when you are in distress? He doesn't say when we are in distress, when you are in distress. And the elders have to say, all right, with this, we've returned you because of this reason. Do battle with the children of it, and that you will become a leader over us, over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Now they sweeten the deal. We're not going to get rid of you when you're done. Now you will have leadership of the entire house of Gilead, which is basically all of Manasseh. Well, all the important parts of Manasseh. And parts of Gad, because there are a lot of intermingling along here. They offer that to him. Now this is where the language is a little bit fuzzy. Because some of our Bibles record it as a question, some record it as a statement, some record it as conditions. Jephthah's second next response. Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, if you bring me back to do battle with the children of Ammon, and the Lord delivers them before me, I will become your leader. Yeah, see, some record it as a question, some record it as a statement. Others record a little bit differently. I'm going to read you how the last recording that I found was. I will become your leader. If you bring me back to do battle with the children of Ammon. And the Lord delivers them. He actually flipped the condition. First, you will make me a leader. Then, I will come back and do battle with the children of Ammon. He made a deal. Yeah. And what did they say?
Okay.
Their previous statement
was... Okay, you got it.
They're desperate.
And then what did they actually do? The following verse, they obeyed exactly what he said. They first brought him back. And says, first of all, they responded, may the Lord bear witness between us. We do according to your word. So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people set him as a leader, first, and a military chief over them. And Jephthah spoke all these words before the Lord in Mitzpah, in his home town. He flipped the condition. They said, okay. They knew he could do it. So he did it. So the leadership happened first. Then, we haven't read that yet, he's actually quite talented. Which we'll discuss that in a couple of weeks from now. Oh, let's see. Did I miss anything? I didn't. Okay. Any questions or comments before I call it quits? It's kind of fun. I have to stop the story now because he's going to go back because a lot more activity is going to happen. But I had to break up chapter 11 a little bit because there's a little bit of distinction between what they get him, they hire him, before they actually do work or he actually does anything. Questions or comments? Yes, Kathy.
Go ahead, Kathy. Oh. I just think it's interesting that, for them to force him out, all 30 of them, it's like 30 against one.
Well, we don't know how many sons there actually were at that point, because it says Jair had 30 sons. He obviously had a lot of brothers. We don't know for sure the quantity of the children.
It still says sons.
There were sons. There was at least more than...
There was two.
At least there was two on one.
That right there is an act of cowardice.
Yes, it is.
And so it just stands to reason that they saw his activities. They knew about them. They knew he was a man of valor.
Mm-hmm.
And... they're not willing, they're not able to come against Ammon themselves. So, of course, they go back to him because they know him. It's just, it goes along with, to me, I see the same character throughout.
It is. It stays that way. Their character doesn't change. Their static character, Jephthah's, changes. Because he actually flips around and shows a lot of remorse in his life and what happens.
Right.
But... they don't change. The Gilead people, his brothers, and of course their sons and whatnot, are all the same. They stay the same. Continuously battle, fight. What's mine is mine. What's yours is mine. Because I can kill you if you don't give it to me. Kind of attitude. Now that was a good thing at times, and it's a bad thing at times. When they were conquering the land of Canaan, that was the greatest asset you could have. Of what yours is mine, what's mine is mine, because I'm going to take it from you. Good thing to have as your military leaders. At this point, the negotiations, a bad trait to have. You don't want that kind of trait or reputation that precedes you. Yes, Pat, you had your hand up a few minutes ago.
Yeah. How did you know? I mean, my Bible doesn't say anything about him leaving behind wife and family.
The end of Leaf chapter 11.
Okay, discusses so you have it. To read ahead.
Yeah, I already knew the answer ahead of time. I brought it up because he did leave it, and he loses his daughter as a result, but we'll discuss that later. And the next time we have this discussion.
Oh,
yes.
That's who that is.
Yes, that's who that is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite sad. That's why Jephthah is a person whose character changes. He realizes and says, oh, okay, there are good things, there are bad things, I've done them both, but there's some things that are just sad and happen to him. And that's just the way it is. And he deals with it. He deals with it well. The rest of Gilead, maybe not deal with it so well. They may have more issues, but we'll discuss that at this point in time, not the next time. Yes, Anne. The
question is, I'm sure that in some of the other characters that we have, things been through with the judges, that there are certain ways of looking at leadership, the characteristics and how a leader, bringing him, setting him up as a leader first and then going on and doing the military feat that was before him. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's a set, order about.
Yes.
The leadership skills were there, but they were being used as marauders and
right.
Or whatever they called them. He called them back then.
We ran across that similar formula a couple of times.
That was God in action, working something out in him to help the people later. But there must be some kind of looking at him as a leader, and then. This order all of a sudden, and okay, first bring me back here and bring me into the tribe again, and mm-hmm. then I'll go and do battle
mm-hmm.
the next step.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying something about leadership.
It does reflect a little bit about leadership, and it happens a couple of times. Deborah was a similar style, not in the thing with the Jephthah, but she was not a military leader. She was an honorable person ahead of time. She did what was right ahead of time, and then God, of course, raised her up, raised up a rock, and they became military leaders, or military as well. Gilead the same way. He was not a military leader to start with. God raised him up and said, first clean your house, the gods and whatnot. Now, then we'll build you up.
You keep saying Gilead. Now, do you mean...
Sorry, Gideon. I apologize. Okay. They sound a lot alike. I make mistakes. Gideon, I meant to say, not Gilead. Gideon, who was raised up...
Named after Gideon?
No. Gilead's named after his ancestor, also Gilead. There are two of them. There are two Gileads, both from Manasseh's line.
Way back when they...
Yeah, way back during... When they were in Egypt, and then when they came out, when Moses was divvying up the land. Gilead's a common name. The second one was more important with respect to his military prowess. One more question. What did we learn? What did we learn about Jephthah? What did we learn about Gilead? What did we learn about God? Did we learn anything at all during this chapter and a half?
Don't forsake the Lord.
Don't forsake the Lord. That's a good lesson to always learn.
And when you are being attacked by the Amorites and the Gileadites and the Philistines and blah, 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 ask God if maybe you should talk to him.
In one way, it's sort of like saying, I'll take your punishment, whatever you're going to give me. Okay, I'll accept it.
This one.
Right. We need your help. Go ahead and punish me. I'll want to get back. But deliver us out from this situation, you know. So sometimes we have to fight the bullet.
That's true. It may not be the bullet given to us, but yes. We do have to fight the bullet.
There were no leader that came out.
No, there wasn't any.
You just said God just delivered, moved him out by his power. Didn't say.
No, there wasn't much of a leader.
Maybe the angel of the sword, you know.
Yeah, maybe. What did we learn about God, though, too?
Forever.
What did we learn about God?
His mercy endures
forever. God's mercy endures forever. The fact that he said, all right, you deserve this punishment from the children of Ammon. And you've pleaded to me. You don't deserve it. I'm not going to give you anything. However, your pleading pulls at God's heartstrings or his soul, tears at him. He says, okay, fine. I'll relinquish part of this. It's going to take, because you're going to have some requirements.
Yeah.
In this case, it was you had to clean up your house, actually destroy those gods you were worshiping all this time. That was a requirement he gave him, and that's what they did. So we actually know a little bit about God. In fact, yes, you deserve a particular punishment that he has dished out to you. However, you don't necessarily have to keep or stick with that one punishment because he has the ability to change the punishment. Not that you won't be punished for doing something that's stupid, but you don't necessarily have to receive the punishment that God initially gives to you, or that you actually deserve.
Yeah, like I said, you get in 20
life,
you might get 10 to 15.
Which, hey, that's 5 less years, right?
And when you're in trouble, he will tell you.
He will. He will let you know.
If you cry out and say, I'm so sorry of everything I've been doing, I'm in trouble here, he will make it clear to you what you have to do.
Mm-hmm. We all make our stupid mistakes. We all get our stupid or things that we don't like, the punishments. They're not stupid. We just don't like them. And we all pray to God that he deliver us from these punishments that we deserve. And frequently, not always, but frequently, he says, all right, I won't give you that one. I'll give you this one instead over here. A little bit less severe, but you still got to pay for it. It doesn't last quite as long.
Is that... When sometimes when God says no, he can change his mind if you do something.
That's
the
true.
The problem is, all right, now I'm going to maybe turn around to a yes. But not a complete yes.
Not a complete yes, but a little bit of yes, Tammy.
This is why God refers to himself as a father, because a lot of times parents are like this too. If you see genuine repentance in your kid, you're not going to confiscate the iPod for a month. Maybe you'll at least confiscate the iPod for a week.
Exactly.
If you
have a little bit of compassion.
You have some compassion, but yet you still may give out the punishment, but you will put a little bit of mercy to it.
And no doubt, you reserve the right to maintain the original punishment. That will be the case sometimes, but it's a good thing to learn about God. It's a good thing to always keep in mind about him. But yeah, the Israelite people get punished every generation. And every generation they ask God to repent or to help. And every generation says, okay, I'm not going to fix it, but I'll help. Okay? Thank you.